Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the December edition of the Chemistry World Podcast, with Bibiana Campuseo, Phil Broadwhite, and Anna Lucock. I'm Mira Senthilingam from thenakedscientist.com. Coming up in this month's show, how mobile phones could soon benefit our health.
We have the latest slightly unusual app for your mobile phone. They've basically implanted a sensor into a mobile phone that will measure levels of nitric oxide in your breath.
Anna Lucock will be explaining how breathing into your phone could be the new way of monitoring asthma. Also on the way, why we have spectroscopy to thank for our understanding of our universe.
Almost all the information we gather about the universe is based on spectroscopy. Up until 1930, it was believed that the composition of stars was very similar to that of the Earth.
And Mike Barlow will be explaining how his team are using spectroscopy to understand the origins of life on Earth. Plus, we meet one of the founders of one of the newest elements to be added to the periodic table.
We bombarded a lead target that has 82 protons with a zinc beam containing 30 protons, and were able to detect a single atom of an element with 112 protons, element 112.
Sigurd Hoffmann will be explaining how his team went about discovering this element and what this could mean for the future of elemental findings. That's all coming up in this month's Chemistry World Podcast.
The Chemistry World Podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
First this month, we discover how scientists have been trying to restore works of art. How are they doing that, Bibi?
During the 1960s and 70s, restorers used to treat artwork with a polymer coating to protect it from damage. It used to act as a sealant and also as a form of protection against light. But over the years, these polymers have oxidized and become yellow or darkened, and they need to be removed. Also, they talk about some interaction with metals using ancient paints as well. So that needs to be resolved.
So how have they gone about removing these?
Yes, a team led by Piero Baglioni at the University of Florence in Italy have designed a transparent gel that can be applied over the surface of the painting. And it is made out of a small amount of a volatile solvent called paraxylene, dissolved in water, and then thickened into a gel with hydroxyethyl cellulose.
And how does this gel actually work to remove the polymers and the damage caused to these art?
The gel has a microstructure of tiny droplets of oil-coated water that are trapped in the cellulose chains. So they will dissolve the organic polymers that have been applied over the surface of the painting. But the advantages are that because these gels are so viscous, they will not penetrate the surface of the painting, which is one of the problems that they had traditionally, where the solvents were actually getting into the porous matrix that was the painting.
So essentially this is going to sit on top of the painting and draw out the polymers and draw out the impurities then?
Yes, and it can be monitored visually, actually, because it's transparent, so they can apply it and see how it cleans the surface. So it's allegedly very easy to use.
Now that sounds great. So what have they managed to use this on so far?
So far, they have restored some wall paintings from the 15th century at the Santa Maria della Scala sacristy in Siena, Italy. And also they have applied it to a gilded frame from the 18th century. So, yeah, obviously it works.
But is it applicable to all forms of art then?
Not yet. The next challenge for them is to design a system that can be used to clean oil paintings. The difficulty with this is that these paintings are made with layer upon layer of organic base paint, and there is the danger that important fixing molecules could be dissolved. So that is the next point that they're going to try and fix.
Okay, thank you, Bibi. And now moving away from pieces of art onto technology now, and that's the mobile phone. Now, I know mobile phones can be used for a lot, Anna, but now they're also being used in medical monitoring of asthma.
Yes, that's it. We have the latest slightly unusual app for your mobile phone. It's been developed by a company called Applied Nanodetectors, and they've basically implanted a sensor into a mobile phone that will measure levels of nitric oxide in your breath.
So how does this work to monitor the levels of nitric oxide, and how is it inserted into your phone?
Basically, there's a small hole in the top right-hand corner of the phone, and within that there's a carbon nanotube and silicon-based sensor. We don't know very much more about how it works because the company is reluctant to release any more details. But basically, when you breathe into the hole, the sensor works out the proportion of nitric oxide in your breath, and 5 seconds later, you'll get a readout on your phone that tells you the amount of nitric oxide in your breath in parts per billion, and you get a traffic light warning icon indicating if the concentration is normal, so you get a green light, or not too good, so you get a red light.
So all people really need to do to monitor this then basically is to breathe onto their phone.
Yeah, that's it. So the idea is that hopefully it will help patients keep a daily record of how they're doing and how their asthma is progressing. And also the information will hopefully be forwarded straight on to their doctor or their healthcare provider so they can keep a record. And if you end up getting a red traffic light warning, they'll be able to drop you a line and you'll be able to arrange an appointment straight away.
Now, why is monitoring the levels of nitric oxide valuable for monitoring asthma in an individual?
OK, so inflammation in your airways causes elevated nitric oxide levels in your breath, and nitric oxide has been used as a biomarker for asthma since about 1995, and using nitric oxide levels as a monitoring test for asthma has been approved by the US Food and Drug Administration for several years now.
And how often will people have to do this then?
Ideally, the developers would like it to become sort of a disease monitoring habit, so you just have a breath that breathe in every day so that you can keep track of how your asthma's coming along.
And I guess just lastly, is it possible to monitor other diseases using this technology potentially then as well?
Well, there are around 200 chemicals that get exhaled in every breath. So if there's a biomarker in one of those chemicals, and if we can find a suitable sensor, then there's no reason why other ones couldn't be incorporated within the phone.
So as well as cameras and emails, our phones could also now help us have daily health checks with our doctors. Thanks, Anna. Now, the field of astrophysics still has many unanswered questions about the origins of our universe. But what we do know so far about our stars and our planets is largely down to the technique of spectroscopy. So to find out more about what spectroscopy is and just how it works, I went along to University College London to meet Mike Barlow.
Well, spectroscopy is a very powerful and fundamental technique that's widely used in astrophysics to diagnose particularly the chemical composition of stars and nebulae and galaxies. It basically splits the light up into its component wavelengths, disperses it, as we say. You then have a detector which collects the light dispersed over its different wavelength ranges. When you inspect the resulting spectrum, you see absorption or emission lines, which allow you to identify them with particular ions or atoms or molecules. And knowing that they're present then immediately gives you information about the composition of an object. In particularly rich spectra, you get many emission or absorption lines, and the ratios of these different lines can allow you to infer the densities, the temperatures, and the relative elemental abundances of the different elements.
And what forms of light and what wavelengths are used in spectroscopy?
Well, astronomers observe the entire electromagnetic spectrum, all the way from gamma rays to radio. There are satellites that have to go into space for certain wavelength regions because the Earth's atmosphere doesn't transmit the radiation at those wavelengths. That includes X-rays, ultraviolet, and a lot of the infrared spectrum. For instance, X-rays, you will see atomic transitions that originate from the inner electrons of tightly bound atoms like iron or oxygen or so forth, the K and L shells as they're called. They can again allow you to infer information about the regions that are emitting or absorbing these lines. You move into the ultraviolet and you see electronic transitions that are from less tightly bound elements, but from very abundant elements like carbon, nitrogen and oxygen. Moving into the optical, you see less tightly bound elements, more like sodium, calcium, potassium. And once you're in the infrared, you begin to see molecular transitions. They can be vibrational in near-infrared, or if you go out to longer wavelengths, which we call the mid-infrared or far-infrared, we begin to see many rotational transitions of molecules such as water or carbon monoxide and so on.
So what do you and your group look at the moment, or what have you looked at in the past, and which type of spectroscopy have you used?
Well, I've in the past used optical, ultraviolet and infrared spectroscopy to understand the composition of nebulae in our galaxy and in other nearby galaxies. The reason for this is we would like to know the abundances of elements like carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, very important elements, the most abundant elements after hydrogen and helium. And if we want to understand the relative abundances of these elements in the solar system and on Earth, we've got to work out how the stars made them by nuclear processes. The stars then later ejected these nebulae, maybe as supernovae, or through mass loss processes of lower mass stars. And they enriched the galaxy in heavy elements over time. So by observing nebulae in our own galaxy and other galaxies, we can diagnose their chemical composition today. We can compare that with galaxies which are less evolved and therefore have lower elemental abundances, and we can look at the patterns in those galaxies. And by comparing the patterns of elemental abundances, we can get information about what types of objects like supernovae are responsible for enriching those elements.
And so what have you found so far about which elements are present here?
We'd like to understand the origin of carbon, nitrogen and oxygen. And one of the puzzles at the moment is we know that oxygen is dominantly produced by supernovae, massive stars that explode at the end of their lives. Carbon is more controversial. For a long time, we thought that carbon came from low-mass stars like the Sun. But more recently, there's been claims that massive stars, too, might be able to make a lot of carbon. So we're going, you might say, back to basics to understand whether it's stars like the Sun that produce most of the carbon or whether it's massive stars going supernova that did it.
And so knowing where the main source of carbon came from then, what can this then be applied to help us understand?
Well, carbon is clearly an important element for our life on Earth. There's a lot of evidence that complex molecules and complex organic dust particles existed in the earliest stages of the solar system and helped get the whole process of life going on a planet such as Earth.
How important do you think the field of spectroscopy, say, has it been to the understanding of our planets, our stars, our universe?
Well, it's a bedrock tool for astrophysics. Almost all the information we gather about the universe is based on spectroscopy in combination with imaging. But with imaging alone, we would know very little about the universe. We need these key bits of information. If I could give an example of what spectroscopy did, up until 1930, it was believed that the composition of stars was very similar to that of the Earth, dominated by heavy elements like iron, silicon, and so forth. And it wasn't until the study of a series of spectra of stars of different temperatures by an astrophysicist called Cecilia Payne-Gaposchkin, she realized that, in fact, hydrogen and helium were far more abundant in stars. And it was that realization that was needed in order to work out what the energy source for stars. Because as soon as you knew that hydrogen was the dominant element, then it occurred to physicists through the 30s that fusion of hydrogen atoms into helium could provide the energy source that was needed to power stars. Prior to that, nobody knew what the energy source was.
That was Mike Barlow, Professor of Astrophysics at University College London, explaining how the technique of spectroscopy has greatly increased our understanding of our universe. You're listening to Chemistry World with me, Meera Senthi Lingam. And still to come, we reveal just how far our DNA can be stretched, and we reveal how chemists go about finding a new element. But before that, we investigate why scientists have been dissolving carbon nanotubes. Phil?
Yes, that's right, Meera. Matteo Pascali and a group from Rice University in Texas have found that carbon nanotubes actually do dissolve in something, and that something is chlorosulfonic acid, which is a super acid, which is even more acidic than concentrated sulfuric acid.
And now, why is it useful to dissolve nanotubes?
Well, a lot of the excitement about carbon nanotubes is about their sort of engineering properties. They're very strong, but they also conduct electricity. But bringing those exciting properties into the real world means being able to process nanotubes on a large scale into things like fibres or films. And that's just not possible unless you can get them properly into solution.
So how does this chlorosulfonic acid actually work to dissolve the nanotubes then?
OK, well, previous ways of making nanotube solutions type things have been to actually physically modify the surface of the nanotube, whereas chlorosulfonic acid is actually a strong enough acid to directly protonate the surface of the carbon nanotubes. This makes them positively charged and they then repel each other, which gets over the problem of nanotubes tending to clump together in solution, which is what stops them from dissolving.
And so what are the potential applications of this now?
Because they can make solutions in liquid crystals, there are lots of established ways of processing those solutions in liquid crystal phases into fibres or films or whatever. So they can use established technology, such as that that's used for Kevlar, to process these into fibres. Then you can start making composite materials, but you can make composite materials that are not only very strong, but also conduct electricity. So one thing that the authors have mentioned is that the aerospace industry, if you think of an aeroplane fuselage, it needs to conduct electricity to survive lightning strikes, which is why aluminium is used quite often. But if you want to replace that with a lighter composite material to save weight and fuel, you still need something that conducts electricity, which you might be able to do with nanotubes.
Well, thank you, Phil. And now staying on the topic of nanotubes, but moving over to their disadvantages, Anna, and scientists are worried about the effects of nanotubes on our health.
Yes, absolutely. If carbon nanotubes are going to be processed and used on a wider scale, it means that a lot more people could be exposed to carbon nanotubes at higher concentrations. And this research that's come from James Bonner of North Carolina State University in the US and his team suggests that inhaled carbon nanotubes could cause some damage when they reach the lungs.
So what damage is it thought that they may have on our lungs?
Well, given that carbon nanotubes have a similar structure to asbestos because they are long and fibrous, it's concerned that they'll have the same effect as inhaled asbestos dust, which was reaching a certain area of the lungs where they caused damage and lung disease.
Now, what area does it reach and why does it getting to this area have a negative effect?
Well, most particles are cleared out of the lungs quite effectively by the body's defences, but it's found that these long fibrous particles reach the pleura, the two-layered membrane separating the lung from the chest wall, and they settle there. They're not cleared out as well as other particles.
And what's the kind of disadvantage of them then sitting and settling there?
Well, people are concerned that they'll have the same effect as asbestos, which was to cause mesothelioma, which is a slow-growing lung cancer, and cause other sort of scarring and tissue damage in that area of the lungs.
What's the kind of evidence backing this? And so how did the scientists look into this?
Well, this is the first research that's been carried out on carbon nanotubes where it's been in a more of a real-life setting. They got the mice to inhale the carbon nanotubes rather than injecting it to some part of the body as they had done in previous research. So the researchers exposed the mice to carbon nanotubes, which they inhaled for about 6 hours, and then they collected lung tissues after 1 day, 2 weeks, 6 weeks and 14 weeks after the inhalation exposure.
But I guess 14 weeks isn't that long in terms of a scientific study. So is this still early stages or is it actually something we should worry about already?
It's still very early stages. This is something that the researchers are very keen to point out. For example, there is no sign of the slow-growing cancer because at 14 weeks, that's simply not long enough for such a thing to develop. But also there are other concerns that there is some evidence of scarring after 2 weeks, 6 weeks and 14 weeks. But that could be down to the catalyst, the nickel catalyst that was used to form the carbon nanotubes. The researchers are very keen to stress that although they found evidence that the carbon nanotubes reaches the same place in the lungs as the asbestos particles, they haven't made any conclusions as to the kind of damage that they do or do not cause there.
So it's something to maybe worry about, but also something that needs just a lot more work to finalise the actual details of this.
Absolutely. A lot more research is needed as to what damage is or isn't caused and how it would or wouldn't happen.
So whilst we should keep an eye on carbon nanotubes, seeing as their popularity in industry is increasing, it's not quite something to worry about just yet. Thanks, Anna. Now, have you ever wondered just how chemists go about finding a new element? Especially an element that's so unstable that it only lasts for a few seconds. Well, this month, for our sister podcast, Chemistry and Its Element, where we bring you the stories and chemistry behind the elements in our periodic table, I met Sigurd Hoffmann, who led the team that discovered element 112. And apparently, this discovery all began with a question.
Our question is simple but difficult to answer. What we want to know is, how many elements are there, or where is the end of the periodic table? The elements beyond uranium, with an atomic number greater than 92, are not found in nature because they have short half-lives, meaning they exist for only very short periods of time before they decay. So, if we want to know how many of these elements, called the transuranium elements, exist, we have to try and to make them in the laboratory. In 1996, we set about producing element 112 inside a particle accelerator. We bombarded a lead target that has 82 protons with a zinc beam containing 30 protons for 1 week and were able to detect a single atom of an element with 112 protons, element 112. As is standard for these types of experiments, we used isotopes of zinc and lead with high numbers of neutrons. Our zinc nuclei had 40 neutrons and our lead nuclei had 126 neutrons. So that the nucleus of our new element had 112 protons and 166 neutrons, meaning it had 278 nucleons, or, as it is more commonly described, an atomic mass of 278. But like many chemical reactions, this nuclear fusion reaction is exothermic and the newly created nucleus is hot. So it cools down by emission of one neutron and the nucleus which we were able to study had the atomic mass number 277. We were only able to make a single atom of this element at this time, because the immensely strong electric forces acting the zinc and lead mean they are much more likely fly apart than fuse together. In a second experiment in 2000, we were able to measure a second atom of element 112, and then, in 2004, scientists working at RIKEN in Japan produced another two atoms of this element. After confirmation by the Japanese group, IUPAC officially recognized my team as the discoverers of this element. And in April 2009, we were asked to suggest a name for it. Within 4 weeks, we selected the astronomer Nicolaus Copernicus to give his name to element 112. Nicolaus Copernicus lived in the period of the transition from the Middle Ages to modern times. Nicolaus Copernicus developed a conclusive model for the complex astronomical observations of the movements of sun, moon, planets and stars on heaven's sphere. The first two of the laboratory created transuranium elements, neptunium and plutonium, received their names, like uranium, from the planets. So, to honor the father of the planetary system, we suggested that element 112 was named after Copernicus. The name we suggested to IUPAC in July this year is Copernicium, with the abbreviation ZN. Apparently, IUPAC are also currently discussing modifying the name to Copernicum, as it is easier to say in many languages. Chemically, Copernicium is located in group 12 of the periodic table, below zinc, cadmium, and mercury. And the first experiments, using the adsorption of a few atoms of the element on a cold gold surface, showed that Copernicium behaves chemically like mercury, although it is possibly a little bit more volatile. We also believe that it will be liquid at room temperature. So far, element Copernicium has not found any practical uses because of the problems associated with making it and the fact it decays within milliseconds or seconds. However, its detection has paved the way to finding heavier elements still, the so-called super-heavy elements.
Sigurd Hoffmann from the GSI Helmholtz Center for Heavy Iron Research in Germany, explaining his team's journey to discovery of element 112, soon hopefully to be named copernicium. And if you'd like to hear more stories about other elements in the periodic table, there's lots more available online at the Royal Society of Chemistry's new interactive periodic table, which can be found at rsc.org/chemistryworld/podcast. Now, for our final news segment this month, we solve a mystery that's plagued geneticists for a long time. And that's how far our DNA can be stretched. So what's been found, Bibi?
Yes, this mystery seems to have been solved by an international collaboration between groups of researchers in the Netherlands, France and Sweden. The issue here was trying to elucidate how DNA stretches.
So up until now, what was thought or what was understood about the stretching of our DNA?
Well, about 20 years ago, it was shown that a molecule of double-stranded DNA could be pulled apart at either end, and something very peculiar happened. Initially, the molecule resists being stretched, but then when you apply a force of 65 piconewtons, suddenly the polymer surrenders and actually stretches to 1.7 times its original length with very little force. And then once that length is achieved, the polymer becomes resistant again. So it's a really peculiar behaviour.
And so what was thought to be the cause of this behaviour?
At the time, there were two competing models. The first one suggested that the DNA remains intact, but when the force is applied, reach 65 piconewtons, the helix unwinds and forms a straight ladder where the base pairs are the rungs of the ladder. The second model suggested that the DNA actually comes apart and the bonds between the base pairs are broken, so the double-stranded DNA becomes two single strands.
So how did the team go about trying to find out which of these models was correct?
They started with a very well-known and well-established DNA stretching experiment, which involved attaching one end of each strand of a length of double-stranded DNA to a polystyrene bead. And then they pulled the beads apart using lasers.
But they were also able to visualise what would happen.
Yes. They basically exposed the DNA to two different fluorescent tags, one that binds to single-stranded DNA and one that binds to double-stranded DNA. So in this way, they made possible that the whole process could be viewed under the microscope.
So using these markers, they'd be able to see if the DNA stayed as a double strand or if it did separate out, as one model suggested, to these single strands.
Yeah, because somehow it would be colour-coded.
So what does happen? What did they find?
Well, the leader of the research, Erwin Petermann from Vrije University in Amsterdam, actually puts it in very clear terms. Pulling the DNA from both ends is like pulling a jacket that has a double ended zipper. When they applied a force over the beads and pulled the DNA apart, the DNA actually breaks into the single strands and it remains zipped in the middle.
So it's like it kind of unzips from each end and then the middle bit is where it has remained double-stranded.
Yeah, the middle remains double-stranded.
So the mystery has been solved. So what now can they do with this information, or what can this lead to?
This is essential because DNA within the cell is subjected to a series of mechanical manipulations. It can fold and unfold, it can coil and uncoil, it can be unzipped and then zipped back up. So a detailed understanding of the elastic properties of DNA is essential so that scientists can understand how DNA interacts with the proteins that cause these manipulations.
Now, moving away from our DNA in our bodies to the environment, where climate change is something that we're constantly having to worry about. And now, Phil, there's a new way that we could potentially get rid of some of the CO2 in our atmosphere.
Yes, Mira. Well, it's not exactly a new way. This is a reaction that's been used to create a class of molecules called cyclic carbonates, which are useful as solvents and degreasers, and they're they're manufactured on quite a large scale in the chemical industry already, but the problem with it is they're manufactured from very pure carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide has to be purified and pressurized, and then the reactions have to be done at very high temperatures. So it's not a very energy efficient process. What would be ideal would be if we could take the wet, dirty CO2 out of the back of a power station and use that to make these useful molecules instead.
How have scientists gone about using this wet, dirty carbon dioxide then?
Well, Michael North and his group from Newcastle University have been developing new kinds of catalysts for this process. As we all know, the efficiency of any industrial process is really down to the catalyst. The reaction that they're doing is taking carbon dioxide and an epoxide, which is a strained three-membered ring which has two carbons and an oxygen in it. You break open that ring and add in the carbon dioxide to make a bigger ring which has a carbonate group in it. Current catalysts either activate the epoxide or they activate the CO2. What this group have done is make a catalyst which has two metal centres and some other bits hanging off the side which activate both components at the same time, which really speeds the whole thing up.
So how would this catalyst actually be used in practice then?
There's two different kinds of power stations in the UK. We have power stations which are called base load stations, which are on all the time, and power stations which are peak load, which are only switched on when there's a very high demand for electricity. The problem with the catalyst is that it has to be regenerated. So it would be ideally be fixed to peak load stations so that when the station's in use, the catalyst can remove the CO2 from the waste a gas stream, and when it's not in use, they can be regenerating the catalyst.
Now, how much of a difference are we looking at here that this catalyst could make?
The global market for these carbonate molecules is significant, but it's not massive. We're not talking about all the carbon dioxide from every power station in the UK. If we removed all of the carbon dioxide from one power station such as Drax, that would probably supply the world's needs for cyclic carbonates. So it's never going to be a total solution. It's only ever going to be part of a grander plan.
Well, any method of reducing our carbon dioxide levels is certainly useful. Thanks, Phil. Now, that's pretty much it for this month. But before we go, it's time to find out the answer to last month's chemical conundrum. So remind us of the question, Anna.
So last month we asked you to name the acid that was used to dissolve the gold Nobel Prize medals of Max von Laue and James Franck so they could be hidden and the metal kept safe during the Second World War.
And the answer, Phil?
Well, yes, the answer was aqua regia, which is a mixture of concentrated nitric and hydrochloric acids, and usually in a volumetric ratio of about 1:3. It's a very strong acid to dissolve gold, but after the war, the gold could be precipitated out of the acid, and the Nobel Foundation very kindly recast the medals. This month's winner is Anna Olchevska from Helsinki University of Technology in Finland, so congratulations.
And what do you have lined up for this month's chemical conundrum, Anna?
Well, to follow on from Mike Barlow's fascinating interview, this month we're sticking with the space theme to ask what analytical technique is being used by scientists to prove the existence of water on the moon.
To entice people to answer this question, what do you have in the wonderful Chemistry World goodie bag?
The Chemistry World goodie bag this month includes Philip Ball's book Elegant Solutions and a glow-in-the-dark RSC pen.
And how do people go about entering?
If you know the answer, you need to let us know your name and address and send your answer to chemistryworld@rsc.org.
And you can, of course, also use that address to send us your thoughts, feedback or suggestions for future episodes. That's it for this month, but have a wonderful festive period and join us again in the new year and, well, the new decade for more of the latest news from the world of chemistry. Contributors this month were Bibiana Campaseo, Phil Broadwith and Anna Lucock, as well as our guests Mike Barlow and Sigurd Hoffman. I'm Meera Senthi Lingam from thenakedscientist.com and we'll see you next month.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.